Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. Again, as always, thanking the most wonderful audience in the field of mental health, psychiatry, psychology, social work, counseling, and throw in some evolutionary science and anthropology, and we've even had some classic scholars here talking about these issues going back well before BC. It's just a pleasure to be talking to you. And what amazing guests I've had on lately. I mean, I'm just sort of at a loss when I do each write-up now for the show because the shows are so good. You know, last week, Jeannie Stolzer, who gave just a marvelous discussion of the human evolution and its relationship to nursing and nurturing and diet and mental health in modern times and the stresses of modern times, my dear friend Jeannie. Before that, I took a break from interviewing people, and I did a show on antidepressants, a whole show. And before that, Joanna Moncrief, the marvelous British psychiatrist, a wonderful woman. And before that, Sammy Tamimi, again from Great Britain, a great child psychiatrist in Great Britain. I don't think we have the equivalent in the U.S. Of Sammy or of Joanna. And then Peter Goetze, who stands by himself as a scientifically minded physician in every arena of medicine and psychiatry. I mean, it just goes on and on like that. So I'm just very, very pleased with how this show is going, and I hope you are too. And tell folks about it. I haven't done a lot to publicize it. And of course, last week we celebrated the 300th airing. And due to the fact that there's some difficulty getting all of these numbers to correspond, I could probably celebrate my 300th again today with my amazing guest, Robert Whitaker. Bob, are you there?
I am indeed, and it's a pleasure and an honor to be here.
Oh, you sound really, really good. I was telling Bob today, folks, that my wife has bought the URLs for a very clever way, I think, of being able to tell people about the resource centers that I'm developing. Three of them are quite developed, and others are on the website but are not yet resource centers, where you can get 100 or more scientific articles organized with a search mechanism and an introduction by me that also takes you to the individual scientific articles. Well, one of them now you can get to on the internet by simply dialing, if I can use the old words here, by simply putting in 123 antipsychotics. And you'll get my antipsychotic and TD website. Dial in 123 antidepressant. Just dial it in as your URL, 123 antidepressant. You'll get my antidepressant website. And dial in 123 ECT, and you'll get my ECT. These are all .coms. It's just the idea just occurred to me, listening to an ad on the air for 123, and it was for something else than my stuff. And so this is a very easy way to remember how to get to these huge resource centers entirely free, no advertising on them. Now, today's show is a part of my having on people who wrote chapters for the book The Sedated Society, The Causes and Harms of Our Psychiatric Drug Epidemic, edited by James Davies. We're going to have James back on to for a second time. And we've had on Sammy and Peter Gertz and Joanna because they all had chapters in this book, but I also have had all of them on many times, so there's lots of reasons. And Bob Whitaker has a chapter called Psychiatry Under the Influence, which I thought was a great title. And I want to mainly just unleash Robert Whitaker, but maybe with a little bit more introduction. I think most of you know who he is. You know, Bob has had a series of very important books, Mad in America, and then Anatomy of an Epidemic in 2010, which everywhere I go, that's one of the books that people have read. It's sort of in the same way that they've read My Toxic Psychiatry. They've read Anatomy of an Epidemic. And now Psychiatry Under the Influence, same as the book title, which is written with Lisa Cogrove. And Bob developed, sponsors, takes care of the amazing website Mad in America. I put up blogs there occasionally, and the numbers I get are better than the numbers I got when I used to bother blogging on Huffington Post. I haven't really blogged there in a long time. So he's got a really good website going with lots of very good bloggers. And practically all the people I've just mentioned, Bob, I think all of them blog on your website, don't they?
Yeah, they do indeed.
Sammy and Peter Gertze and so
Joanna.
On.
Yeah, yeah. It's really a home for people, you know, with a critical psychiatry viewpoint and perspective.
Well, let me unleash you to talk about whatever you want to, including okay. Psychiatry Under the Influence or any of your new activities. It's yours to talk. I've been talking too long already.
All right. Well, Peter, thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure being here. Well, I thought since you've been doing these interviews with you know, some of the authors of other chapters for the Sedated Society, I'd really focus on, you know, what I wrote there. And for this did come from the book Psychiatry Under the Influence, which was a little bit different perspective for me in the sense that, you know, I got into this whole writing about psychiatry first for looking at whether drugs, you know, whether our belief, our societal beliefs in drugs were really, really merited, that they fixed chemical imbalances and were highly effective and that sort of thing. And then from there I went into looking at larger histories and larger narratives within psychiatry. That was Mad in America. And then I focused on in Anatomy of an Epidemic, really was, you know, what are the long-term outcomes with psychiatric drugs? But Psychiatry and Influence, which in some ways was a sequel to that, is really looking at this. You know, how did we get this particular narrative that has driven our care since 1980, which is when the American Psychiatric Association published its third edition of its Diagnostic and Statistical Manual and, you know, adopted its so-called medical model. It's really a disease model. And looking at how that model came to be and then how psychiatry since promoted that model and did so operating under twin influences. One influence, of course, was pharmaceutical money. Because what DSM-3 did is it dramatically enlarged the categorization of people who were going to be seen as mentally ill or have a psychiatric disorder, and therefore dramatically enlarged the potential market for psychiatric drugs. So, of course, pharmaceutical companies began sending money to the APA and leaders in psychiatry, leaders meaning academic psychiatrists, because to help them expand the market. But then the other thing is there was another guild, there was another influence, and that was psychiatry's own guild influence. In other words, in order to promote the interests of psychiatry as a guild, it decided it needed to tell this medical model story. So first look at how DSM-3 came to be, and we can talk about that in a bit. Then second is how that led to these twin influences. And then third, and this is the most important thing, is how those twin influences corrupted the narrative that was told to the public and corrupted the scientific findings that were reported to the public. And what you really find in a big picture here, as we chart our way to the Sedated Society, is that mainstream psychiatry, the American Psychiatric Association and thought leaders within American psychiatry, thought leaders being these academic psychiatrists, have regularly told us a false story. They've told us a false story about chemical imbalances. They've, basically spun findings from clinical drug studies, including studies funded by the NIMH. They've hidden bad results. And the end result is that we as a society have organized ourselves around a false narrative, a narrative that was pitched to us as a scientific narrative, but is in fact a commercial narrative, belied by their own science. And then also what is quite amazing is how this false narrative was then successfully exported really around the world, and we got this disease model taking over in country after country. And finally, and Peter, you and I can discuss this more, because I don't want to go on forever, but the question then becomes is, well, what is the social injury to society when it organizes itself around a false narrative? And you find evidence of the damage done, the injury done, everywhere you look, and it starts with an increase in the number of people disabled by mental illness. That goes on. You see that in every society that has adopted this paradigm of care. You see this pathologizing of children, and that leads to, I think the evidence is pretty clear, a bad end for many, many children. And also just a philosophical sense of self that has changed, where we no longer see ourselves as a resilient, able to make changes in our life. It's a very pessimistic, a reductionist view of what it means to be alive. So that's, you know, as how my chapter fits in this larger book. It's really looking at how did this narrative come to be? What is the evidence that it's a false narrative? And what is the social injury? And when you look at it from that way, you can see that this whole story is doing great, great damage to our society.
Well, this is the opening of a huge conversation, and well put. I think one of the things I would first think of when you were speaking is the harm done in particular to vulnerable populations, children, to some extent women, the elderly, people in jail, people in any kind of institution. So while everybody's vulnerable, we've got infants being given these drugs, and maybe you could talk more about that too. While everybody's being harmed, the vulnerable populations that can't fight back, resist, stand up for themselves, get particularly injured.
You know, Peter,
and I think the point. Go ahead.
No, that is such a great point. Because all these vulnerable populations are populations so often that aren't making the choices for themselves, right? They're under, in some way or another, either, children obviously aren't making the decision for themselves to take psychiatric drugs. Foster children, which are, you know, guardians of the state, are just getting hammered with these medications. The elderly, in some ways, start to lose autonomy to make their own decisions as well. People in jail, when I used to work in prison a long time ago, I worked in Attica prison in the late 1970s. At that time, very, very, very few people were medicated. Very, very few people had a psychiatric diagnosis. I'm talking about the inmates. Today you go into a prison and they're all on medications. They all have psychiatric diagnoses. And that becomes an extra burden on them, frankly. So, and women, you're absolutely right. I think there's something like 25% of women, you know, of adult women, 25 to 55 or something like that, on antidepressants. And all of this is, when you talk about vulnerable populations, like, say, children, foster care children, people in jail, people in institutions, is the reason that society embraces this so much, the incredible use of these medications, is because we're told that these drugs are fixing known biological problems. And look, don't we want to provide medical care to these vulnerable populations? Wouldn't it be terrible if we didn't provide such care? So this is exactly what you see results from a false story. So the story is that these are fixing some known pathology. Then we as a society say, okay, well, then we should give this to children. And then, of course, the people so medicated, the children, the foster care children, the people in prison, do not have a voice to speak for themselves. And in fact, when they do try to speak for themselves, the old adage is, well, they don't know what's good for them. We know what's good for them. And I forget where this quote is from, but, you know, there's something particularly, there's particular reason to worry when someone else is telling you what is good for you. Anyway, I think this is a really good point, Peter, that what you're talking about here is what when you have a false narrative and when you have agents, chemical agents that can control people, quiet people, make people less emotionally engaged, make students, quote, less disruptive. Well, those are the people who are going to be first or in particular injured with great frequency by this form of care and by this false narrative.
You know, there's another group which I've never called them this, but which get the what do you call the damage that goes along when you bomb a place? Collateral damage.
Collateral damage.
The
right.
Civilians who get well, that's the unborn child, because the mother who takes a psychiatric drug is exposing the child to the drug, because all of them go through the placenta, all in some varying degrees, but since they all go through the blood-brain barrier, or they wouldn't work, they all go through the placenta. And then they also pass through mother's milk. So the nursing infant also can be affected by these drugs. And you have children born whose mothers have been on lithium, and they're flaccid, because that's the apathy-inducing effect of lithium, and they have neurological problems. And children on antidepressants are born, and they go into withdrawal from the antidepressants. They have whole varieties of potential problems. And same with every group of drugs.
No,
they're born with often a withdrawal and sometimes with outright damage.
You know, we... at Mad in America, you mentioned in your nice introduction. So we have a paper on this, and focusing on the research, we put up a paper on research related to use of SSRIs in pregnancy. And the data in terms of the percentage of mothers, pregnant women, using SSRIs is a little hard to come by, but it seems that it may be as high as 8, 9, 10% at least. And so what do you see in those studies? Well, what you see... I mean, there's all sorts of alarming findings about raising all sorts of risks, early birth, cardiovascular risks, et cetera, et cetera. There's children so born to mothers, they seem to hit developmental landmarks later. But of all the different risks I've seen, maybe the most pronounced risk that shows up in that literature is this. That serotonin is a molecule that really it is so important to normal fetal development. It helps, for example, the different cellular levels in the brain organize themselves. As you know, the brain is this extraordinarily complex organ, and the cells have to migrate to different layers and levels and layers. And anyway, serotonin is a molecule that apparently helps guide that process. Now, what happens is in animal studies, if you take a pregnant rat and expose it to an SSRI at an appropriate dose for the body weight for a period of time, and then you watch what happens to the fetal rat, then the pup that is then born to that mother rat, and then you sacrifice them. Well, what you see in that fetal rat is their brains are organized differently. You can literally see that the cortical layers are not normal compared to normal rats. And you also find that if they don't sacrifice those fetal rats, they end up having behavioral problems as adult rats compared to normal rats. Now, think about this just for a moment. You have animal studies that suggesting antidepressant use in pregnant women is causing the fetal brain, you know, abnormalities in how the fetal brain organizes itself. I can't think of anything, any sort of more profound collateral damage than that. And yet, what are we doing about it? We at Mad in America wanted to do a campaign to get a black box warning. It sort of fell apart, partially just because of our lack of resources. But shouldn't we have a black box warning of that? I mean, isn't this what medicine is supposed to do, is safeguard the health of people? I mean, and who who needs more safeguarding than the fetus that is developing? So, and as you know, Peter, you've written about this. It's not unique to the SSRIs. You see it in the antipsychotics. You see it in these other medications. And our failure to warn mothers about this, I think, is just extraordinary, and it's a national tragedy. And it also goes again, so what's the narrative around SSRI use in pregnancy? Oh, you got to use it because the depression is so bad for the fetus. It's just an example, a particularly tragic and compelling example of harm done from a false story and what is pitched to the public, because you will not find mothers being told about this extensive research showing that use of SSRIs in pregnancy raises all sorts of risks, including this risk of abnormal brain development.
There's a phrase in the literature, mostly outside of psychiatry, called developmental neurotoxicity. And it's the fact that toxicity, neurotoxicity of any kind, will affect both the development of the fetus and the development of the born young animal or person. It's all very clear. It's all out there. And our experience with things like cocaine babies should have made us very, very aware that this is what drugs do, and fetal alcohol syndrome and so on. I mean, it's not like there's a mystery here and that we just could not have possibly anticipated these terrible outcomes because we had no precedent. In fact, we could have anticipated. I did. I predicted these outcomes, wrote one of the earlier papers on the SSRI outcomes. You know, we've known this a long, long time that it would be inevitable. There's no way around it. It's been helping me to talk about neurotoxins, because psychiatric drugs, as are all psychoactive substances, are toxins to the neurons. They poison neurons and neuronal activity. There's no way around it. They meet every definition of a neurotoxin. And one of the things I've found in researching this, I haven't published any of this yet, is that the very same drugs that come up in the psychiatric textbooks come up in the neurotoxicity textbooks, and things like neuroleptic malignant syndrome for the antidepressants and serotonin syndrome. For the antipsychotic drugs, it's neuroleptic malignant syndrome, serotonin syndrome for the antidepressants. Lithium in general is often discussed as a well-known neurotoxin. In fact, one neurotoxin textbook opens up discussing lithium. So, wow, it's just not a mystery. It's just so evil.
The thing is that if everyone understood right from the start that these drugs are not normalizing any abnormality, well, then you very quickly understand that they're creating abnormalities, and those are abnormalities go down to how cell functions, cell shapes in many instances. And as you say, all those things are signs of agents that are, you know, doing harm ultimately to the normal health of the brain.
Absolutely. Now, I basically refocused what was a very good opening discussion by you on the breadth, on the societal level of these effects. So having kind of also then bored down and look at just the direct damage, to which I would add every class of psychiatric drugs that we know of has evidence for causing long-term brain damage with cognitive deficits and even atrophy of the brain. It isn't all the drugs all the time, but certainly all classes of drugs we now know damage the brain. Would you agree with that? Do you think there are some exceptions to that rule?
Well, certainly you see like cognitive impairment long-term with benzodiazepines. You see cognitive impairment, of course, with the antipsychotics. The SSRIs, I think, are going to be... you do see cognitive impairment long-term with the SSRIs.
Yeah.
You see memory impairments.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
I think you're going to actually see a lot of early dementia show up, and maybe it's already showing up in long-time users of SSRIs. I guess the one class of drugs that I might question in terms of cognitive impairment of, although they have all sorts of impairments, but the stimulants. I don't really know about the data on cognitive impairment with use of stimulants.
Well, nobody wants to study it, but I mean, we know what happens to methamphetamine users, and we've got multiple studies showing atrophy of various parts of the brains of children and young adults on these drugs. It's often quite varied. And there are some studies of cognitive impairment as well. I think I cite some of those in my writing. So, I think that's clearly there. Then we have it with lithium, which takes us into the area of the mood stabilizers.
Right.
You know, one of the things that we forget is that one of the early sedative drugs were the phenobarbitals given for epilepsy, and they are very close in their effects to other sedatives more commonly used now in psychiatry. And there were good studies showing loss of IQ, lower IQ in children treated with these drugs. So it just not good. I think it's an across-the-board toxicity, neurotoxicity.
Peter, I think you can. What you do see over and over again is, you know, functional impairments, risk of functional impairment goes up, risk of cognitive impairment goes up, risk of psychiatric, you know, symptoms goes up. All those things are, and, you know, risk of mortality goes up. So all of those things are telling of drugs that are doing harm over the long term.
Very, very much. And then you start doing these cocktails is what happens to people.
That's insane.
They get on the cocktails. And then it's deadly. Your studies, would you talk for a minute, because you really drew attention more than anybody, I think, even more than me, to the shortened lifespan issues of these drugs. Do you feel up to talking about that now?
Well, yeah, listen, then, of course, then they came back with that. But, you know, we see, of course. I mean, especially with antipsychotics, you see people dying in their 40s and their 50s now that with great regularity that have been on these drugs for 20, 25, 30 years. Absolutely consistent with what you'd expect with drugs that induce metabolic dysfunction, diabetes, and you know, obesity and all these problems. So if you look at public mental health clients today, they're dying on average something like 25 years earlier than normal, which in most areas of medicine would be seen as a disaster, especially when it's not like in the absence of these medications there's any known pathology in people so diagnosed. And you're seeing it too, by the way, in bipolar groups as well. And I know with the antipsychotics, there's even some sort of dose-related, you know, mortality rates. But here's the amazing thing about this narrative. So this comes out that people with public mental health clients are dying 25 years earlier than normal. It's getting worse, too. The studies say in the 90s, it seems like early death, and 90s and early 2000s, that early death is more of a problem. This, of course, is happening as people are on these incredible cocktails, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 drugs. And then we get this study out of Finland, which supposedly says that use of antipsychotics lowers your risk of mortality if you're diagnosed with a psychotic disorder, and therefore it's like a life extender. No, I'm serious. They have this study.
I laugh because I don't want to shriek on the air.
But, and you see this cited all the time. You need to take your antipsychotics because it reduces mortality. Well, if you actually look at that study, there's so many problems with studies like this. You know, they mined a database. But if you actually look at the data in that study, it was an 11-year study, and they looked at their registries in Finland of medication use, and they said, look, there's this group of people who are dying who don't take antipsychotic medications or who died at a higher rate than those who did. Well, the first thing you notice is the group off medication is much older right from the beginning. So you might expect an older group to have a higher mortality rate. But the real kicker is this. You actually see in this data, and then there were some questions. People said, well, maybe this, you know, who are these people off medication that supposedly have all these years? But if you look at medication exposure during that, I think it was an 11-year period, you know which group had the lowest mortality rate? This is among schizophrenia patients. Those on medication 6 months or less. And then from there, with each sort of additional year of exposure, mortality increased. So the whole way they were able to make this claim was that somehow they had this baseline group that didn't take any medications in 11 years, and they had a higher mortality rate than any of the other groups based on medication exposure. But it was an older group right from the beginning, and we don't really know who that group is. But when they group it by medication exposure, increasing exposure over that time led to increasing death rates. And yet, what are they? How do they spin it? Oh, the medications protect you against death. I mean, it's just, this is an example of how stuff is spun. And even against, you know, all sort of reason, why would drugs that cause diabetes, metabolic dysfunction, and all the other things these cause be life extenders, protect you from mortality? It just makes no sense.
Do you have a blog or an article that focuses specifically on the lifespan issue?
No, you
I'd
know
love
what?
To put it up on my resource center.
This is my next to-do list because I really want to go into the data. When you look at, for example, there's been studies that followed real cohorts of patients. And I think one was in Ireland, one was in England, and then they followed them for 5 years. And they found that there was a dose-related mortality risk. In other words, it wasn't just whether you were on or not, but the higher the dose led to a higher death risk. So now those are mortality studies in real people, okay? In other words, you have a cohort, you're following individuals, and you can mark up death rates. This other Finnish study was not really a study in real individuals. It was data mining a database in which they looked at, because in Finland they have these incredible registries of medication use and of, you know, whether people are dying, et cetera, and they just matched the two. That's a very different thing than following real cohorts. Anyway, you asked me about this. Yeah, this is the next thing I want to do, is really look at the early death data and distinguish between, you know, what are the studies really finding, dose-related elements, and also how this one study misrepresented its results. I'm talking about the Finnish one that said antipsychotics were protective of life and increased mortality. Yeah. Increased, you know, decreased mortality. It needs to be done.
Let's go back to these broader implications for society. You know, we're raising children who believe that they are damaged and therefore entitled. What a terrible thing to do to people. I see this when I treat youngsters here in Ithaca, New York. I treat people from college and from Cornell University, and some of them have been declared ADHD, and they take untimed exams, or they get other advantages in exam taking.
Right.
And that's terrible for them, I believe, because it gives them the idea that they're somehow damaged, but also that it's okay for them to then go on and try to do what everyone else does or does well, even though they've gotten this special pass.
Right.
I was talking to a judge a few years ago in Pennsylvania who had me into his district to give a talk on drugs and kids. And he said they were talking about allowing people with ADHD to take the bar exam untimed. And we laughed at the irony of this, that they should put up their certificate, but they should say that they are an ADHD lawyer, and that is, they may work more slowly, their hours they will charge you will be longer, their concentration isn't as good, they may have trouble keeping track of things in their office and during a trial. I mean, it's so bizarre. It's so thoughtless,
yeah.
This corruption of standards that psychiatry contributes to.
Yeah, Peter, I think this goes to this larger story of conceptions that was born in 1980. As you know, there was no ADD or ADHD construction prior to 1980. Attention deficit gets born at that time. I mean, we have this something called minimal brain dysfunction, but that was a very different deal. So all of a sudden we have this construct, which really is applied to kids unhappy, not doing well in school or talking too much in school or whatever it may be. But this is a new way of thinking about children because, of course, before this, we had kids responding in all sorts of ways to school. You know, we had some who were the goody-two-shoes, and then we had the rebels, and then we, you know, there was all sorts of different things. But whatever the categorization of people was, descriptive, it was these are children. They come in many different sort of behaviors, and also this. The child's behavior wasn't necessarily prelude to adult behavior, right? We grew up. And so that's one way of thinking of childhood and the human being is, yeah, children struggle. Children come in many different sort of behavioral types. But one of the things is they grow up and they become adults and then they become responsible for themselves. That is a description of childhood that basically you see in literature, novels, religious texts, going back forever. And then all of a sudden in 1980, we define childhood in such that you say, listen, if this kid's not doing as well in school as some people would like or talks too much, we're going to say he has a pathology, which in fact, is, in the minute we do this, it starts to have all sort of the ramifications you say. This person suddenly now, that individual now sees themselves different. It becomes part of their internal narrative that somehow they're not equal to others. And then next thing you know, as you say, we build a society where that person now gets special sort of privileges. And it's either sort of like, snowballing effect of away from sort of conceptions of childhood and responsibility that we used to have to these new conceptions, these new societal standards. And I think you're right. Maybe if you get an extra time for the bar, you should have to say, I passed the bar with these supposed, differences in mind, and I had more time. I think I don't even know what the rule is for flying now for pilots. Can pilots have ADHD? Can they have a diagnosis and still become a commercial pilot? Do you know this?
No, actually, I never looked into that. I was actually hired by the FAA to defend them in a lawsuit where a pilot wanted to fly on SSRIs. But then with time, I know they began to allow pilots with supervision, I guess, to fly on SSRIs, which I think is an absolute disaster. We've already got that pilot who drove his plane into the French Alps, the German who was on psych drugs. I don't know about ADHD. Used to be you couldn't get in the army if you had ADHD and were taking stimulant drugs, and now that's gone by the wayside, I believe. Of course, they want to give stimulants in the army.
Well,
that's
now they give them all
on a broader
crazy
scale.
Drugs, yeah. But I think this is the point, Peter, in terms of going back to what you raised. You have the damage in terms of the internal narrative that it becomes to the person. And yet then the society itself starts making all these adjustments for it that, take away from this fundamental sense of, on an individual level, you're born, right? One of your whole struggles is to, first of all, sort of become comfortable to your mind, but also to accept responsibility for who you're going to become, right? And in the sense that you're not going to ask for any head starter, so to speak, or longer time. And I just think it builds a self-conception that is the opposite of resilience and self-responsibility.
Oh, well, I'm so glad to have you say that, because that's one of my deepest beliefs, is that the diagnosing and drugging is robbing children and adults of a sense of responsibility. It's quite amazing. On occasion, I have simply suggested to parents that they take moral responsibility for their kids and talk to them seriously about their behavior and expect them tomorrow, the parents are in today, tomorrow or tonight, to respond, to just look at them and saying, you don't have to behave that way, Timmy, and I want you to stop. And I've had total changes in a day or two. And sometimes it takes 2-3 weeks, but never if it's just a plain kid labeled ADHD and he hasn't got very serious trauma or other issues. The parents can fix this through my instructions, with my only seeing the kid once or twice, or not at all. I've had it happen where I didn't even get to see the child at all. It happened so quick that the parents turned the family around. So another thing is, we're robbing parents in our society and teachers in our society and ministers and coaches. We're robbing them of the sense that any child, and certainly the vast majority, if not any child, can be reached by an adult who has a sense of their own appropriate moral authority. The kids aren't incorrigible, which is another thing that this whole thing teaches us. Incorrigible, they have to be drugged. They won't respond to the Catholic priest like they did in that wonderful movie, I forget the name of it, where he said there are no incorrigible kids, everyone can be reached.
Right.
Go ahead.
No, Peter, I think this is two things here. This new world, this new post-DSM-3 world, it says all the problem resides in the inside the head of that individual, right? And not in between the spaces. In other words, not in how we're responding to an environment. And so, you know, if you have a bad school environment, a kid's not responding well, it's the kid's fault. Or if, you know, if a kid is born into a bad home, a home that can't keep him safe, you know, and he goes into the foster care system, it's the foster care kid's problem. He has ODD or bipolar, it's a problem with his brain chemistry. So it locates all problems in the individual rather than in these in-between spaces, which brings you to parents and other mentors. Listen, I once went out to this facility in the Bay Area of California, which was run by this extraordinary psychiatrist named Tony Stanton. And this was called, you know Tony, right? This facility was called the Seneca Center, and it took care of the, quote, worst kids, provided residential treatment for the worst kids in California. And they had a grading system that, where level 12 was the kids seen as the most disturbed kids. No hospital wanted them, no foster care wanted them. And these kids were the end of the line, level 12 plus kids. And they arrived at his center, medicated up the kazoo, you know, they couldn't get their heads off, and seen as, you know, basically incorrigible, horrible, violent, or whatever. But Tony had this belief: no human being can organize their behavior except in response to others, and particularly to model the behaviors of others, parents, teachers, big brothers, big sisters, people they want to be loved by and want to love, in essence. So in other words, his child development model is that's how we learn to organize our own behavior and control our own behaviors, is in response to others, and then we try to model their behaviors, and also those others give us some standards that we now need to conform to. And you know what happened there when he had this idea? Well, you know what? Those kids, and they came in really, really problematic, and I'm not going to say that all the problems got solved, but they didn't leave that place until they'd become better at organizing their own behavior. And when I was out there, Peter, what I saw, and I'm sure you've seen this 1,000 times over, is these kids, these very troubled kids, were so hungry for affection and so hungry for someone to, like, sort of respond to them. So, again, what you're saying here, it's almost like we've created this society where we don't believe that kids model their behaviors, or that they don't learn to behave within sort of cultural standards. But of course that's how kids grow up. They model their behaviors on others, and they learn, well, what are the cultural expectations?
This leads me to think about maybe a whole other area we could explore, maybe more than anybody has previously on the show or maybe anywhere, which is how the drugging of the kids takes society off the hook for solving its problems. So if you drug your most active, creative, independent, maybe potentially defiant kids, I certainly was a kid who stood up for myself. If you drug all those kids, you don't have to reform the school. If you've got a classroom of 30 people with a teacher who hasn't been trained very well or isn't enthusiastic for her job or wishes she were retired or he were retired, and you can just drug up to anywhere from one or two to all the kids in the class, if it's a special class, then you don't have to reform that. You don't have to reform your school system in general, because most kids will be docile, especially if they see, you know, 10%, you know, two or three kids in every classroom getting drugged or more. And then that takes away responsibility from parents, takes it away from teachers. If we drug all the folks in nursing homes, we don't have to improve the nursing homes. And literally, that's what we do. We go in and we give them antipsychotic drugs or any mind-numbing drug, but often antipsychotics. We make it much easier for the nursing staff. And indeed, we can literally kill the patients that are the most difficult. And nobody in the family has any idea what has happened. In the Army now, soldiers who are stressed out due to the conditions of warfare, they're actually now often drugged while they're in combat. This was unheard of before the Iraq wars. I mean, if you were, you know, drugged either by yourself or somebody else, a psychiatrist in previous wars, you were brought off duty. You were considered not responsible. So now we're unleashing these violent soldiers. In the area of religion, Bob, ministers no longer think that they can handle somebody who's despairing, when that, I think, should be the core of what religion does, which is offer the despairing hope, offer the depressed hope, offer the anxious security and hope. Instead, most ministers and priests nowadays, if you use any words that sound serious about yourself, they're going to send you to the psychiatrist. There's so many areas.
Yeah, Peter, I think
I don't know if you could pick up on all this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is exactly right. I mean, this becomes you don't have to worry about social justice things. You don't have to worry about making more supportive institutions, because you're saying that the problem is always within the individual and not with the social structure of whatever it might be. Take schools, for example. So you have schools where, you know, you have long days, and then, of course, now sometimes they give them like 4 hours of homework a night. But you can now have schools with 30 people in a classroom. You don't have to have gym. You don't have to have music. You don't have to have art. You don't have to have things where kids are allowed to go out and play and, you know, roll around. Because if someone's not happening to their environment, it's not the problem with the school environment and whatever, how we're arranging those schools. The problem's with the individual. So that's a classic example where society's not saying, like, well, what should our schools be like? And should school have, you know, gyms and music and art and that sort of thing? Same with, you know, and go down right the line with whatever you said. And by the way, I hear you about teachers, but in some ways, we don't even support the teachers in this new environment like we used to. So, for example, the teachers used to be, if I would have come home with a sense that I had misbehaved in class, my father wouldn't have been calling the teacher. My father and mother would have been saying, well, why aren't you behaving? So my point is that teachers really do not have the backup so often now, and I say this as someone whose daughter is a teacher, where, you know, that the raising of children is understood to be, yes, schools are having an important part, but it's sort of a partnership between schools and parents and providing a cultural context. And instead now, it's like, I don't even, it's like, if it's not going right in whatever school we set up, then it's the kids' fault. I mean, it's just a way of avoiding setting up a nurturing society. And look at the foster care situation. we all know what happens in foster care. It means that the kid drew a short straw in life, right? And what you really want to do is build some sort of structure that helps those kids, gives them some opportunity to, you know, get an education and make something of themselves. And the minute you drug those kids, what happens? They become less emotionally responsive to their environment, whether it be in school or in foster care, which means they're less able to learn. They're less able, in fact, to form the very emotional bonds we talked about, where you need to model yourself after others and care about others as a way to organize your own behavior. So it's such a bad way for society to try to create a better society, so to speak, when you have, it's not about the institutions, it's not about how you organize your social structures, but you blame the individual, and then you make that individual less responsive. Of course, the nursing home thing is the same thing. You know, basically, those become like, now we have to spend less on caring from the elderly. And the combat thing, it's you know, why do they need drugs to go back into combat, like in, during the Iraq War? Well, that's because, frankly, we as a society didn't gear up for, I mean, whether you're against that war or for that war, generally in the past, wars were supposed to be, if you're going to have a war, you know, it's a responsibility of all society to engage in participating in that war. But what happened, of course, with the Iraq War is these soldiers kept going back and back and back again to these tours of combat. And, you know, I know my father served in combat in World War II, and I will tell you that the one time of combat he had in Italy of about 6 months in foxholes and all, I don't think he could have gone back. So, again, rather than figuring out, well, what is our responsibility to those individuals in the Army or whatever to make sure they're not exposed this way to these repeated combats, instead we just numb them out and say, okay, you're ready to go back. I mean, it's another
example.
Also,
Bob, you know, we give them rules of engagement that would make anybody crazy too, which I think are being changed now. That's a little more political, but, you know, they almost have to call home to call the president to get permission to fire back at anybody. So
yeah, that's a whole other thing. But yeah, I mean, I don't even, and Peter, I don't really, I've heard about this, I don't know enough about it, but I do know that a society that sends these young men and women repeatedly into combat situations is just doing horror. That's so harmful to those individuals. And we see it. Look at the disability rate among returning people from that served time in Iraq. It's really high.
Very, very high. Let's go, and we've got, I don't know, maybe 5 minutes left. I think we should go back to what is one of the major sources that we haven't talked much about today at all, but you're very aware of course, and that is the pharmaceutical industry. That one of the things that has happened to the world is that the pharmaceutical industry is taking over a huge part of the functions of society, and it is so wealthy that in every area, including the practice of general medicine, it is horrendously corrupting medical education, college education, the way we think about ourselves as human beings. It's so much of the critique you and I have been unraveling really, really became overwhelming when psychiatry in the late 60s and early 70s was failing and went into partnership with the pharmaceutical industry. And that gave it a huge lift in the area of psychiatry, but also the medical people have gone into partnership with the pharmaceutical industries for an even longer time. So that we're really staring at what I lately I've changed from calling it the psychopharmaceutical complex to the pharmaceutical empire. Your thoughts on that? You've been writing about it. And,
yeah, sure.
What are
I
your
mean,
thoughts
you know,
about that?
I think about it, so obvious. You know, in other words, it's not just people taking psychiatric drugs. I read something the other day that the average 60-year-old's taking like five different drugs. And, of course, that's not how people used to grow old. Listen, I think what you're seeing here is that the pharmaceutical industry, as a business, has done an extraordinary job about creating markets for its products and lifelong users for its products. And in that sense, what we have witnessed over the last 40 years is an extraordinarily successful creation of markets. And, you know, that's what businesses try to do. They try to create markets for their products. And the way that, but of course, we think this is not supposed to be a product environment. It's supposed to be a medical environment. That's where you get this clash. But the other thing you're talking about, Peter, is how did they bring these, how did they build these markets? Well, what they built these markets by co-opting the individuals in our society who have the medical authority and medical legitimacy, meaning, you know, the doctors, and not just psychiatrists, but doctors, you know, at prestigious medical institutions. And they basically found a way to turn them into, you know, at some level, they're salesmen for building these markets. And you see it with standards for diagnosing this and that being lowered and then that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, just on something as simple as blood pressure, the standards, you start drugging much sooner in America, where the pharmaceutical industry has the most power, than you do in Great Britain, where the pharmaceutical industry doesn't have quite the grip. So that strangling grip of the pharmaceutical industry is a great part of the cause of what Bob is calling this narrative. It's a narrative written largely inside pharmaceutical companies, who then co-opt, as you mentioned, the doctors, and I'm sure you'll agree, the big associations, the Adolescent and Child and Adolescent Academy, the AMA, the American Psychiatric Association, even now the American Psychological Association.
Yeah, that's true. You know, Peter, this is one place I disagree with you just a bit. I think this narrative in psychiatry was co-created between the American Psychiatric Association and academic psychiatrists and the pharmaceutical companies. I don't think it was imposed on.
You know, I think that's reasonable enough. But it wasn't until psychiatry went in cahoots with the drug companies that this narrative really got the hold. But I agree with you. And there's probably a co-creation with the medical doctors, too, because, you know, they want to have their monopoly, the medical monopoly, rather than health providers who don't prescribe drugs, for example, and there are many different kinds of those. But I agree with you. This is a partnership.
Yeah.
But it's the money. I'm sure you agree. It's the money of the pharmaceutical industry that's made this thing fly.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, just in psychiatry, we went from spending about $800 million on psychiatric drugs as a country in 1987 to more than $40 billion today. That's a 50-fold increase in revenues and sales, so that's pretty big.
It's a good way to end. Folks, I'm talking with Robert Whittaker, one of the really great contributors to the understanding of the critique of psychiatry, and one of the great publicizers as well. And although Bob always says he's a journalist, I genuinely consider him one of the most important scientists of our era. You are a scientist, sir. It isn't a degree that makes a scientist. It's a viewpoint.
Thank you very, very.
What do you say to that?
I'd say that's very kind, and I really appreciate it. Thank you very much, Peter. You're too kind.
Thank you for being on the show, and thank you for my marvelous audience. And thank you to PRN, and thank you to Jesse, my engineer, and thanks a lot, everybody who supports the show.